This is a presentation by Human Development Outreach and Extension at Cornell University.
All right, well, this is the empirical life section of the session today, which is why they're allowing me to do it. You can really do all the statistics in this session with one good set of fingers and toes. And so that really sort of raises the first question, which I'm sure has been burning in your mind, is why study Delaware? Because it's not quite intuitively obvious that Delaware is sort of the epicenter of the death penalty in the United States. Why did we decide to look at that? Well, number one, because no one's previously looked at it. If you build it, they will come. So we decided to go and look at Delaware. Number two, because it's a small state, and thus that really allowed us the possibility to look at every homicide for the complete period of time that Delaware has had the death penalty, which has not, to our knowledge, been done. So where you look at all homicide cases over a 30-year period, essentially. Whoops. Number three, it has a very high death sentencing rate, the third highest in the United States. And four, during this period, Delaware has used judge and jury sentencing schemes, so it gave us an opportunity to sort of look at how these different schemes in Delaware have worked over time. So that's why. So let me sort of briefly orient you and then tell you a little bit about what our preliminary findings are. Well, first, okay, this is a three-phase project. Phase one, which I'm really going to focus on here, looks at all cases in which the defendant was sentenced to death. Phase two looks at all cases which essentially went to the decision maker as a death case. All cases where the defendant was found guilty of capital murder and where the jury or judge decided what the punishment should be. And we are about a third of the way, I would say, ballpark through with that. And I'll have a few observations about that at the very end. And then finally, phase three, where we're going to look at all cases of death-eligible homicides, or probably just all homicides in general. And that is a work in progress, not going quite as quickly as we envisioned 3 years ago when we started and thought we'd wrap this baby up in about 18 months. But we hope to sort of move forward with this as expeditiously as possible. So Delaware, in 1977, they enacted their new death penalty law. Actually, there's a little bit of a story before that. In the wake of Furman and Delaware statute being struck down, they initially backed the wrong constitutional horse and enacted a mandatory scheme. So that's sort of the backstory here. After that was then subsequently validated in Woodson, they came up with their new sort of system modeled on the Georgia statute, which is what most states did that had mandatory statutes after Woodson and Gregg and the other cases, which required the jury to find, beyond a reasonable doubt, the existence of at least one aggravating circumstance, and then the jury was required to unanimously vote for death. So that's sort of the scheme and how it works, pretty common scheme in the United States. But as often happens with the death penalty, sort of one bad case can screw the whole thing up. So what happened? In 1991, you had a highly publicized homicide in the state of Delaware, where it's a very, a bad crime, as if, the other ones aren't bad crime. That's not really not a bad murder. This is a particularly bad murder, and the defendant was not sentenced to death. So what happens? The Delaware legislature runs into session and decides what we need to do is get rid of jurors. They're the ones who are mucking the whole system up and not sentencing enough people to death. So we're going to turn this over to judges. So now they go to sort of what I will call Florida model, which is upheld in profit. So the jury issues an advisory recommendation and opinion, which the judge is supposed to give, great weight to, but it's not binding. And then the judge is the ultimate decision maker. This is sort of basically, how it worked. The jury didn't have to be unanimous. They frequently were not unanimous. I mean, just because they weren't really told they had to be. There wasn't really any responsibility to really deliberate for any period of time, and then what they told the judge was advisory. But now in 2002, right, they had to change again because much to the surprise of virtually lots of people, including me, the United States Supreme Court held in 2002 in Ring versus Arizona that juries at least had to make the death eligibility requirement. They don't necessarily have to be the ultimate sentencer. They do have to find the existence of the death eligibility factor, whether it's a capital murder scheme or the sentencing phase. And so Delaware is one of the few jurisdictions that actually went to this. Most states just went to sort of straight, that went back to jury sentencing. But Delaware adopted a model where by the jury finds the aggravating circumstance, then their work is sort of is done. Essentially, they have an advisory opinion that the judge actually sentences. So we have really here three different schemes, which is another thing that sort of made this system of some interest to us to study. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is give you sort of a little walkthrough of the Delaware death penalty by these numbers, quite small, in fact, by the small numbers. 45 individuals have been sentenced to death in Delaware under these schemes. There are currently 19 individuals on death row, and I'll tell you a little bit more about them. And 14 death-sentenced inmates have been executed, which is a pretty high number, given the thing. Okay, well, so the clearest thing that we found so far is that there is a significant difference between jury and judge sentencing in Delaware. Between 1977 and 1991, 10 defendants who were sentenced to death by juries. This is a 3% death sentencing rate if you look at the number of people sentenced to death in relationship to the number of homicides, which is what we're looking at here. From 1991 to the present, 35 defendants have been sentenced to death by judges, and that yields an 8% death sentencing rate. This is highly statistically significant. At least Ted Eisenberg tells me that it is. And so I will report it to you with that. And it also means that it's impenetrable and you can't ask any questions about it. That's sort of the scheme we have, 3% versus 8%, which is a big, significant difference. So the change did, at least from the legislature's perspective, have the intended effect. More people were sentenced to death at higher rates once Delaware went to judge sentencing. So we can't really do much more with this until we look at all homicides. But the initial impressions are right that race is playing a substantial role in the Delaware death penalty. If you look at this, essentially black defendant and white victim cases, significantly higher rates of death sentences being imposed in the state of Delaware. If you compare it to other jurisdictions, if you look at, compared to Georgia, Indiana, Maryland, Nevada, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Virginia, just for example, just a few that we picked out here again, you continue to see very high death sentencing rates really in every category across the board, but where it shows up the most is in the black defendant, white victim cases. So we will be doing more with this in the second and third phases of this, but right, our initial impression here is, boy, this is something that really needs to be pursued. The prima facie case, and that's all I'll call it at this point, is a prima facie case, is that race is having a very significant effect in the administration of the death penalty, in the selection system of who actually gets sentenced to death. Again, this is just sort of a visual, for those of you who are more visual in nature and don't like to look at the numbers on charts, I'm just showing you what I just showed. Okay.
Quick.
Yeah, pardon me?
Quick.
Yeah, right. If you had to be a quick visual one. Another thing about Delaware is that we said it's small. It is small, right? But it also only has three counties. So that's kind of interesting. So we thought we'd see, sort of following up, looking at geography, locale, sort of like you guys did. In 29, was 66% were sentenced to death in New Castle County. Well, this is the largest county in the state of Delaware. It's where Wilmington is, which is the largest city, I guess, metropolitan area in the state of Delaware. 29% were sentenced to death in Kent County, and only 5% were sentenced to death in Sussex County. Again, we will know more about this in the phase to come, and again, the numbers are small, but this is a striking finding. The very low number of death sentences in Sussex County. And none of the intuitively obvious answers explain this. There may be other things in the future, but none. Because Sussex County actually has more murders than Kent County, which is sort of its closer counterpart. And it also has a smaller black population, two things you would have sort of looked at. Well, maybe does this explain the fact that almost no one gets sentenced to death in Sussex County? So the intuitively obvious answers aren't there. We're going to explore this more. What was interesting was I talked to a number of people in Delaware after this and said, well, you know, if you guys explain this to me, I talked to some people, some prosecutors and some defense lawyers, just asked them. And no one had any explanation for this, and no one had actually even noticed that nobody was being sentenced to death in Sussex County. So I didn't glean much from those interviews, but we're going to continue to sort of pursue this in the future. Okay, just again, Kent County has 16% of the murders, 29% of the death sentences. Sussex County has 19% of the murders and 5% of the death sentences. So this is just sort of reinforcing what we've seen in other states in which we've conducted studies. The Missouri study is that where you commit the murder has a significant role, or appears, at least in Delaware, appears to support the general notion, has a significant role in what the outcome of the case is going to be. Okay, currently on death row in Delaware, 19 people, all male, 47% are African American. Again, this is compared to 41.7% nationally. 7 are white, 37% compared to 45% nationally. 3 are Hispanic, 11% nationally. The total non-white death row population is 64%, 52.7% nationally. Again, the numbers are small here, right, so it's hard to say this has had any statistical significance or not, but, it's just sort of reinforcing the theory which we need to pursue further is that race is a significant issue in the administration of the Delaware death penalty. Executions, there have been 14 executions. Again, just sort of 7 white, 6, 43% black, 1 Native American. 7 were from Newcastle, 7 were from Kent, and 4 were volunteers. So that's about 28%. The national average is about 12%. So at least with these small numbers, a high percentage or incidence of volunteers. Again, in some ways not that surprising, but still nevertheless it looks to be a number of volunteers in the jurisdiction. Whoops. Okay. Another thing we looked at in this phase was appeal and error rates, and so I want to, how much time?
Until 3:13.
I'm way ahead of pace here. I can even slow down. And appeals and error rates. So we decided we would look at that. So we looked at all the opinions of the Delaware Supreme Court reviewing sentences of death. They decided 50 cases on direct appeal. The conviction was reversed in 5, the sentence in 10. The United States Supreme Court reversed one other case in the direct appeal process, getting you sort of an overall error rate of 32% on direct appeal. If you take state post-conviction and federal habeas corpus into account, you had 4 who prevailed in state post-conviction, 2 in federal habeas corpus, giving you sort of an overall error rate in the system of 44%, which is lower than the national error rate reported by Liebman et al. In the broken system studies of 68%. So a fair amount of error being found, a little lower than the national average. But I think that one thing that's significant which needs to be looked at is what's the cost, or is there a cost? In cases where error was found, 68% of the individuals were subsequently resentenced to life in prison or a term of years. And more than one-third of all individuals sentenced to death in Delaware were subsequently resentenced to life in prison or a term of years. So the numbers will actually right, ultimately be much higher than this because there's still a substantial number of people with appeals pending in the process. This is sort of the resolved cases of the people that have been sentenced to death. More than a third are no longer on death row and are serving life or a term of years. I want to briefly talk about the life cases, and then I will stop. Okay, there have been 93 life verdicts throughout the relevant time period. And by life verdicts, again, I'm talking not about cases that pled out, not about cases that were disposed of in some other way. I'm talking about 93 life verdicts in cases where the prosecution sought death, the case went to trial, the person was convicted of murder, and then the jury or judge had to make the life-death decision in the case. So 93. 70 of the in Newcastle County, you had 70 life verdicts as opposed to 29 death verdicts. In Kent County, you had 16 life verdicts as opposed to 14 death verdicts. And in Sussex County, you had 7 as opposed to 3 death verdicts. Now, of these death verdicts, 30 were imposed by juries as opposed to 10 death sentences. In other words, you had about a 25% life chance of being sentenced to death in the jury regime if your case went to penalty and then the jury had to decide it. And 63 in life sentences were imposed by judges as opposed to 35 death sentences, which means you had a 36% chance of being sentenced to death if your case was decided by a judge after conviction in the post-91 era after Delaware modified the system. Okay, so that's briefly what we've done. We're going to continue to explore this in the hopefully not too distant future as we continue to work on this. And we're going to try and look at and see if we can explain through some other ways this high death sentencing rate relative to other patterns. We're going to continue to pursue the racial issue, the racial patterns in sentencing, and see what we can come with on that. And then we want to see if we can do more sophisticated work on judges and juries and have that death sentencing rate in there and see if we can sort of tease out a little more about what happened and give some more context to the difference in the sentencing patterns.
Okay.
321.
I think I'll go without the microphone here. Can everybody hear me? Okay. So this work, as you can see, I hadn't seen any of the life case stuff, so that's new to me. But this case is definitely, work in progress. So a lot of what I'm going to say is about the questions that it raised for me. And first, I want to give some comments about what I think it does on its face as it stands now, and then what I think its value will be as it continues along. So first off, I think this work, like the work we saw in the first paper, really offers another building block in the network of research that seeks to document the contours of capital punishment as it's been practiced in the modern era. So there's this kind of large project going on. Some people are connected with each other doing it, and some people are independent of others, who are beginning to really paint a picture, a very descriptive picture, of how the death penalty functions in this country, state by state. So the early, as the paper points out, the early cases were really coming out of the South, and then there were some kind of industrial Midwest states being done. More recently, we've seen work come out of the West, so Radelet in particular is looking at some Western states, and how does the death penalty look there? How does race function in these cases? What are the geographic differences, county by county, within a single state-level jurisdiction, and so on? And this work fits in with some other kind of mid-Atlantic, East Coast states that have been under scrutiny recently, including Maryland, New Jersey, Philadelphia, and Pennsylvania, particularly Philadelphia, have been looked at in recent years. So as such, I think it's got a lot of value. I think it's really important to sort of, when we talk about the death penalty, when we talk about the problems of it, to really be able to paint this picture and understand what are the nuts and bolts of how it's functioning. I think also this paper has the potential once, or the research, once stages 2 and 3 are completed, to help inform some of the explanatory questions that have been raised by these kinds of studies. Most of the state-level studies are finding, vast geographical differences county by county or within a single state. Many are finding race effects, particularly race and victim effects, and some are starting to tease out, and these are questions that you raised and that I think were raised by Sherry in her comments about how that stuff happens. Is it prosecutorial decision-making? Is it jury decision-making? And so on. There's some of this work is, talked about gender issues, social class of victims in particular, and I think as the stages go on and as the researchers get the larger data set of death-eligible crimes and, sort of winnows out who ends up getting death sentences, they'll be able to deal with some of those issues and help perhaps explain why they work that way. particularly of interest to me is sort of the function of the prosecutorial discretion, which we've heard about already today, in determining which cases will even be pursued as capital cases, and all of that will come, I think, in stages 2 and 3, and I think will be valuable for this larger project. As it stands now, I think this work makes a few important contributions and raises even more questions for me. First, as I just alluded to, it does add to this mosaic level, mosaic of state-level studies that's just important on its face. And while, as the authors have noted, there's a lot of work still to be done, there are states to be done, I think it's this kind of gritty, nitty-gritty work at the state level that has to happen over the next few years before we can really kind of tackle the death penalty as a problem in our society. So putting Delaware into this mix, even though it's small, I think is important. Second, I think this state is really interesting, and I think we saw some of that due to the statutory changes that happened, and that's more unusual. I think that makes the Delaware case particularly interesting and probably makes Arizona the most interesting case that's not being done right now, as far as I know. So while it may be of limited practical importance because of the Ring decision, so Ring has sort of constrained the judicial role in sentencing to some extent. In Arizona, it completely wiped out pure judicial sentencing and put in jury sentencing. It does have important implications, I think, for understanding about how both prosecutors and judges behave in these kinds of cases. Particularly provocative to me is the notion that the extremely high rate of death sentencing for Delaware relative to other states with capital punishment statutes appears to be at least in part a function of this judge sentencing period. So what they're finding is this stuff, the high rate is coming out of those years when judges had the real authority to do sentencing. So it sounds like the juries were barely there just to sort of talk about it, say something to the judge, and then the judge would do what he or she pleased on the case. A couple of questions were raised by this finding for me. First, did this scheme encourage prosecutors to seek death in more death-eligible cases than they had when they faced the jury? So during that earlier period, and then again now that they've got juries have more say, will that stuff start dissipating? And the data can't answer it as it stands now. I think as the life cases come in and then as all the death-eligible cases come in, they'll be able to answer that question. Or was it really a function of prosecutors bringing the same kinds and numbers of cases, but the judges were just much more prone to death sentencing to death than juries? And again, we got some little inkling with the life cases today, but even that doesn't quite tell us because we don't know the universe of the cases. We don't know the characteristics of those cases to know if the judges were that much more, you know, the 36 versus was it 24% judge versus jury. But those are really interesting questions to me. And then the interaction of those two things, how does the prosecutor think the judge will act? How does the prosecutor act before different judges? And are there certainly county-level differences that may help explain the larger geographic disparities that they've seen? And then finally, a question that I had and that wasn't answered for the paper and that I'd like to know is the nature of the statute itself that and how that might contribute to these high rates of death sentencing period, and particularly, just that in general, that there's a small description of the statute, but I'm wondering, is it extremely broad and therefore allowing prosecutors to bring in just about any kind of case? Because it's really by the, it's per murder, that rate's not two cases that are going, but it's to the rate of murder. So my thought is that it must be a high, a very broad statute. And I, in particular, would like to know what the statutory aggravators are, because I know you explained that that's what they need to find is the statutory, at least one statutory aggravator, but I'm curious as to what those might be. So let me just finish up with some questions that I expect the researchers to address as they continue on this project. I think that these questions really can be answered for a couple reasons with this Delaware set. Again, the advantage of smallness, there are a limited universe of cases that have happened since the modern era has started. So there's really the room to delve in deeply. I don't think you can do that in a state like California or Texas, or a lot of other states that have the death penalty. And second, and this became in the paper, there's a statutory requirement to keep good records on death-eligible cases, I presume because there's a pretty strong requirement for proportionality review in the state courts, and a requirement that certain data be kept about those cases that go to trial. So that, to me, suggests you guys are going to have some really rich data to deal with, and should really be sort of interesting in terms of analyses that you're going to do. Some of the questions that you can answer will cut across all these kinds of studies. So the question of why disparities exist as a function of victim characteristics, defendant characteristics, geographic characteristics, and so on. And then other ones are specific to Delaware, such as those I just raised in my second point, which are, you know, why, what makes this a high death sentencing state? It's a very interesting question. I'd like to know what the other, what the two others are that are higher. It wasn't in the paper, and I was going, I wonder what states they were. And are there similarities between those states that may explain that? Do you think, and what do you think you'll find, that those rates will drop over time with the change in the sentencing statute, which again is sort of a hybrid? It hasn't totally gone back to jury, pure jury decision making. It sounds like they're just responsible for making that aggravation finding, and then the judge again has a fair amount of discretion, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in cases since 2002. To what extent are prosecutorial policies and politics at play? Are there issues of resources in these counties? That was something that was raised for me, in that some counties just have more funding, are willing to put more money towards putting on death penalty trials, because it's a huge burden, particularly on small counties, to prosecute and seek death. And for me, from an ideological injustice perspective, the question of these vast differences by county under a single state statute is a huge justice question, and it's something that's being dealt with in California right now. There's some recommendations about trying to narrow the statute so that you don't have these huge, in some way, so that you don't have these huge differences between counties in terms of outcomes. And to me, that's probably the number one sort of attack on the death penalty as it's being operated right now, because it does raise a number of questions, and it's so prevalent in every state for reasons known and unknown that we've seen. So, thanks.
Okay, I didn't write all this down. I think I sort of have them somewhere on the metal hard drive. But as to the statute, the Delaware statute, I mean, is basically pedestrian. In nature, by that I mean it's not overbroad. I mean, the truth is, right, most of the death penalty statutes really look the same now. You have a few outliers, so what you've seen over time in all the states is that they continue to add to the list of aggravating circumstances every time it looks like some murder happens. It might not be death eligible 14 different ways, and they want to make it death eligible 16 different ways. They'll pass like two or three new aggravating circumstances. So it's not as if the statute is overly broad in the scheme of things. It's just sort of a pedestrian, regular death penalty statute with a whole bunch of statutory aggravating circumstances. So I don't think that explains the death sentencing rate. Another thing that's sort of interesting about on the county level, which I forgot to mention, is that Delaware, unlike most states, purports to have a single decision-maker system. In other words, they purport that the Attorney General makes the decisions whether to seek death in all three counties. Now, there's some question as to whether that's really true or not, but at least, on its face, or how they react if the district attorney who's actually got to try the case in a particular county says, I don't really want to do it. But I think that's another thing that makes it interesting, as opposed to these other states. Supposedly you have a centralized statewide decision maker, in that. The judges, the jury, how the judges selected, Valerie, you would know this better than I know. There's been no change.
I don't think so.
Throughout the system. And you want to briefly describe how they're selected?
It's a governor appointment. Legislative approval. So. for a life term or a term
no,
of years?
No, number of
a term of years.
Yeah.
No popular elections at all?
No.
No. So anyway, that's a factor. As to Nancy's question, well, you know, everybody's been here, you know, griping about geography. Well, what difference does it make? I guess, is it a constitutional problem? You know, I don't know that it is a constitutional problem. It might go to some type of issue about arbitrariness. It is nevertheless an interesting phenomenon, right? And you see what you see in many counties. Delaware's so small, so you don't see it. But, for example, you know, when we talk about, for example, the Texas death penalty, there's really no such thing as the Texas death penalty, right? What you have is a Harris County death penalty and a few other states. In South Carolina, you know, where I'm from, there's really no South Carolina death penalty. Over one-third of the counties have never sought or obtained a death sentence. But what you have is a couple counties where you have prosecutors, I'll call them, and then I guess you could say this is a value-laden description, overproducers. You know, they overproduce death in their jurisdiction. And what happens, really, if you think about it, the rest, but then the people that overproduce, we also know from a previous study that Ted and I did, that the counties that overproduce also produce more reversals. More of these cases sort of get reversed on the system, and sort of more of the resources going into that. So what you have is essentially the state is subsidizing the citizens of the state, the money the state's going to subsidize some particular prosecutor's pension for trying to obtain the death penalty. And that might not be a constitutional question, but it nevertheless seems to be a policy question of some importance that people should be thinking about. Well, do we all want to pay for, you know, this person's desire to seek and obtain death sentences? So did I answer everybody's question?
Yeah, the universal data, if you have it.
You mean the override data?
Override data, yeah.
You know, I should have put that up. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact numbers. But I think of the death sentences imposed, only about, one thing, let me back up. It's to call it override is a little bit of a misnomer here. Although I report it as a misnomer, there was some question for a period of time about whether the judge was supposed to give great weight to the advisory jury. Initially, that wasn't in, it's not in the statutory scheme. The Delaware Supreme Court came down somewhere sort of in the middle of this period and sort of adopted a version of what in Florida is called the Tedder standard, which is you're supposed to give great weight to it. I think it's about one-third of the judge death sentences were overrides.
Question over here.
The question was speculation of why the judge is more likely to impose a death penalty than the jury.
Mm-hmm. My belief is the working assumption, which is open, is that, number one, okay, judges aren't stupid, right? In general, you know, the state has a general proposition. They're not. So they know why did they go from jury to judge. The legislature went from jury to judge because they believed that there were not enough death sentences being imposed. The judges in Delaware are appointed by the governor, but they are up for reappointment. You know, I think most judges want to remain judges. And so at least the theory would be that they're, you know, more, at least at some level, you know, more, I don't know what you can call it. I mean, again, you know, the way I would put it might not be the way you would put it, more susceptible to sort of the pressure of the situation. You know, maybe it's just more in tune. Or, you know, I mean, I guess the other side you could look at is,
It would be interesting to look at some of the characteristics of judges, too. I mean, from the perspective, maybe judges have more experience with death penalty cases,
we didn't report this in here, and it's a little lucky because the numbers are so small, but if you just sort of eyeball it to the casual observer, there appear to be some overproducers in the judicial line as well. You know, that I think really that of the 35 death sentences that were imposed in this era, I think four judges account for like 85% of them.
One other question.
Yeah. Can I just respond to this question and elaborate on John's about why judges, at least in this state, would be more likely? My reflection is you've got that article with Ted and Gels, right, that
combines a number of different states and shows that if you've got a judge as the death penalty decision maker, you actually increase your likelihood of a death sentence. So that's across states.
Regardless of employment.
Despite Arizona, we'll have to look at it. Yeah. Arizona is a very interesting judiciary, actually. So maybe we can talk about that. The other thing, it's kind of consistent with typical judge-jury differences in which judges tend to be more punitive in criminal cases than juries.
On conviction rates through all the way through.
Yes.
I'm just curious, maybe David might want to answer this too. There's huge emphasis in the death penalty from geographic variation. To what extent does that correspond to the literature on prosecutorial discretion or judicial discretion more broadly on geographical variation? Is this in the same? I mean, I think that there's a literature that says there's a fair amount of variation across jurisdictions on any sentencing and any, prosecutorial or judicial decision making. To what extent is the magnitude that you're observing in line with what typically is observed in these kinds of cases, or is this like qualitatively different? What's the framework here?
I honestly can't answer that. I mean, I know that literature exists, but I can't make a comparison.
I mean, we just compare sort of on the murder one, murder two line versus the life versus death line. I mean, it's there in both, right? But I haven't compared it to other stuff. But I think part of it is, people probably care about it more in the death context, right? I mean, if you're talking about, are you getting 3 months versus 6 months for that defense, and there may be big disparities across counties there, it doesn't seem like as big a deal, right, as, if you're living or dying. Can I also just say one other thing about what was said here? On this individual judges, one of the things that you might want to look at that's sort of interesting in Missouri is you do get judges who you might call over producers, but it's partly because in the small, and you may not have this in Delaware, but in the smaller counties, they got an automatic change of venue. And when they get an automatic change of venue, there are certain judges that both defense attorneys and prosecuting attorneys can agree on as that's a fair judge, we think he does a good job in the death penalty case. So a lot of the death penalty cases go to certain small group of judges because basically when there's an automatic change of venue, they got to agree on where it's going.
This has been a presentation by Human Development Outreach and Extension at Cornell University.